Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Norma Walden, a program coordinator of the club's International Relations Forum. We also welcome our online and radio listeners, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker this evening, Joe Lurie, is Executive Director Emeritus of the International House at University of California, Berkeley. For those who don't know, that is a multinational residential program center serving 1,000 residents from 75-plus countries annually. Joe Lurie is also a cross-cultural communications trainer. His clients around the world have included many leading organizations, both corporate and nonprofit. He is author of the recently released expanded edition of the award-winning book, Perception and Deception, A Mind-Opening Journey Across Cultures. Joe was featured in a PBS documentary broadcast across the U.S. and in China, and he has been interviewed by the Travel Channel. In addition to his current book, Joe co-authored Close Encounters of a Cross-Cultural Kind. I know we have some returned Peace Corps volunteers in our audience. Joe served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Kenya. Please help welcome Joe Lurie.
Again, thank you all for coming. The topic of the talk tonight is called Globalization and Its Disconnects. And it's really the subject of the new chapter I wrote for the book, Perception and Deception, A Mind-Opening Journey Across Cultures. And the whole book really is about misunderstanding, miscommunications across cultures, and ultimately even within cultures. And I think it's more significant today than at any time, because I see globalization as causing, through travel, through technology, through unprecedented immigration, more contact with quote-unquote strangers than at any time in the past. And those contacts without context often, in my mind, creates sometimes tragic, sometimes funny, but more seriously consequential misunderstandings and misperceptions across cultures. So where did this all start? As you now know, I was a Peace Corps volunteer where I began this awakening to the fact that what I was looking at was not necessarily what I was seeing. So let me give you an example of that. This gentleman here has volunteered to come up to the stage and to make believe that you were Joe Lurie back in 1967. Right?
Okay.
And I am Joe Lurie's Swahili instructor. In those days, I think to this day, Peace Corps gives very intensive language training. And I remember after the first class, I, the Swahili teacher, came up to me, now this gentleman here, and said, well, how are you, Joe?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Right.
And you?
And I'm doing okay. And why did you choose to go into the Peace Corps?
I thought I'd like to help people.
Right. And so what are your expectations? What are your fears? What are your anticipations?
It's an open slate.
It's an open slate. And how are you feeling right now?
I'm feeling fine.
You're feeling fine.
Well,
I'm doing okay. I'm doing okay. So what happened with me, and full disclosure, I am of heterosexual background. So for 20 minutes, this conversation went on, and my Swahili teacher from Tanzania was holding my hand like this. So because of my prism, my narrative, this was making me very nervous, right? And what did I realize as a result of this? I realized that, my God, hand-holding is culturally defined. Did you know? Thank you, sir. Thank you, Joe. You're accepted. So hand-holding is culturally defined. Throughout Africa, I would say it's probably at least 90% of the men you will meet hold hands, and it has nothing to do with homosexuality. In the Middle East, you can find men who hold hands. In parts of Asia, you can find men who hold hands, having nothing to do normally with homosexuality. When I told this story to a Nigerian friend of mine who came to San Francisco the first time, he broke out into laughter, and he said, Joe, when I first came here to San Francisco, right, with a Nigerian friend, we wanted to explore the Castro. And so both of them walked through the Castro, through their narrative, through what they were used to doing, hand in hand, and they couldn't understand why so many men were inviting them into bars. Now, on a more serious note, let me try to make the leap from those original minuscule awakenings to other cultural realities to what I think is happening today. One of the other things that struck me while I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Kenya, when I would go to the market, I would notice that children would refer to many women as mama. Okay? So I had done a little reading about Kenya, about other countries in Africa, and, you know, most Americans don't know that there are over 50 countries in Africa and over 3,000 languages. And basically, at the time, when I heard this, I thought, well, maybe these are polygamous families, many mothers. But then I noticed that the children also called many of the men papa. Not one man, many men papa. And then I learned that, you know, there is in many collectivist societies, there is a collective responsibility to take care of children, right? To discipline them, to nurture them, to take care of them in many different respects, even if it's not your child. So recently, I was reading about, and actually I wrote about it in the new chapter, it was a story about a refugee from a Middle Eastern country where there were a tremendous sense of collective care for children. And this woman who came from the Middle East basically came to Nebraska, and after a couple of weeks, late one night, she noticed a child walking in the street, seemingly alone. And the child, maybe 4 or 5 years old, referred to her as mommy. But it wasn't her child. And so she took the child, as she would in her own country, held her hand, grasped her, and then all of a sudden there was this scream from down the block. The U.S.-American mother saw this and said, "Get away from my child!" And so there you have again what was normal in one context converging with what was normal in another context. This is not your child, causing a collision. Let me fast forward to something that happened on the UC Berkeley at International House recently. A gentleman from Spain, Barcelona, in fact, came to UC Berkeley and he moved into International House with his U.S.-American roommate. You know why I'm saying U.S.-American? How many of us realize how many Latin Americans are offended when we refer to ourselves as Americans without us being exclusively referring to one country? And this gentleman who had come from Barcelona, you remember back in about a year ago there was an ISIS bombing in Barcelona? He came to Berkeley about 2 weeks after that bombing. And when he moved into the room, he looked out the window and he saw these gentlemen with turbans on, long beards, handing out flyers, and he said to his American roommate, "ISIS is outside." Because that was his most recent and visceral reality. The American roommate, who had been living at International House for a while, had begun to realize, well, wait a second, maybe this could mean something else. So he went down to the street to see what these flyers were and who these gentlemen were giving out flyers. The flyers basically were calling on people to volunteer to give food to the homeless. And who were they? Turbans, long beards, does anyone know? Sikhs. Yes, Sikhs. Had nothing to do, of course, Sikhs, for those of you who may not know, are not Hindus, they're not Muslims, they're not Jews, they have their own religion, right? Did you know that they don't call themselves Sikhs? Did you? Okay. How many of you did not know they call themselves Sikhs? Okay, so here it is. The next time you meet somebody from the quote-unquote Sikh background, you may say, "Gee, I learned at the Commonwealth Club that in your language, Punjabi, the mother tongue of many Sikhs, you call yourselves Sikhs. Sikhs." And why did Sikhs, and they've been in this country for many, many years, right, back into the 19th century, why did they decide to call themselves Sikhs? Because they realized through the American prism, people would think they would be contagious. Well, I'm sick, right? So that's why they call themselves Sikhs, right? So now when I came home from the Peace Corps, Here is a short story that underlines the premise and all of the stories that I tell in this book, whether it has to do with diplomacy or business or health or religion or people from over 70 countries that are characterized and spoken about in the volume that I have labored over for many years. I came home from the Peace Corps and I met a teacher, was exchanging stories with her, and she said the following: I have a daughter who's 3 years old, and the first time I took her to Central Park, my daughter saw a bird flying freely in the air, and she said, the daughter said to her mother, Mommy, where is that bird's cage? Where is that bird's cage? So the first time this child had seen a bird flying freely in her home, there is a bird in a cage. So basically, she took her reality, right, and she demonstrated many of the things I had begun to learn in Kenya. And that is that every one of us, I hope you won't be insulted by this, but all of us are in a cage. Every single one of us is in a cage, no matter how much we've traveled, how well-read we are limited by the experiences we've had. And so what I'm going to try to do now is to illustrate this with a few images, right? So you see two images here. What does that say? Ice cream is good. Now, you probably are getting the feel for this already. This is not what this says. Okay? This says, let's see here. I'm just learning about the culture of technology now. This is what it says. Right? That is what it says. And sometimes people don't really get it. But if you look carefully, basically ice cream is good is the top half of these letters, right? And here it is. Ice cream is good, that's the top half. If the bottom half is the rest, the reality, right? So because we take all of us a certain narrative with us, that narrative ipso facto often blinds us to what we're looking at. What does that say? How many see Paris in the spring? Raise your hand. Wrong! So for the radio audience, I've just flashed an image that says Paris in the spring. Oh! You see how we are all in cages. Right? So another way of looking at this is a 4th century Chinese poem, which is also a reference that I use to explain how I am trying to get at misunderstandings, misperceptions across cultures. And this is how it goes. How shall I explain the sea to a frog that has never left its pond? So all of us have ponds. All of us have cages, right? Some of our ponds are bigger. But how shall I explain the sea to a frog that has never left its pond? So this is really the secret of why so many of us, and I continue to make these mistakes myself, don't understand what we're looking at. Who's that? The Ku Klux Klan. How many of you thought of the Ku Klux Klan as soon as you saw that? Okay. Who knows who this could, what else could this mean? In southern Spain, I think even in southern Italy, there is a tradition that in Easter time, people come out to do penance. This has absolutely nothing to do with the Ku Klux Klan. Now, if you only had that exposure to the Ku Klux Klan, like that student from Barcelona who only had one exposure to basically ISIS, it shaped his vision of what he was looking at, right? So the Ku Klux Klan, and I know people who've been to Spain of various different backgrounds who have such a horrific reaction to this when they see it without realizing has nothing to do with the Ku Klux Klan. Okay, very quickly, here is a drawing of a distinguished person. And it was given to me by a visiting scholar at Berkeley before he was going home. Now, I just want a quick show of hands. If anyone thinks they know who this is, and if you don't know who it is, what kind of a person it is? Who is that?
Darwin.
Sorry?
Darwin.
Charles Darwin. Wrong. Next.
Tagore.
Maybe.
Leonardo?
Leonardo. A few more. Maharishi. Okay. You. Right. This always happens that in... Always happens that at some point somebody says, this is you, Joe. All right, so this basically, this scholar, I can now tell you, was from India, and he drew this portrait, and he presented it to me as a gift, right? And he presented it to me with two hands, as in many cultures, this is the proper way and respectful way to present a gift, right? And you are to receive it with two hands, not one hand like we do. It's a different way of offering things. And I hesitated because most Americans, when they get a gift, most, not everybody, what do they do? They say thank you, and then what do? I got the gift. Open it. How many of you, when you get a gift, you open it? Let me see. Oh, that reveals something about our culture. I want it now. Well, let me see it now. So he gave me permission. He'd been in this country a while. He realized that many Americans, not all, tend to open the gift right away. I opened it. I looked at it, and I said, oh, what a beautiful picture of Sigmund Freud. Why Sigmund Freud? Because my wife and I had been in Vienna 2 weeks earlier at the Freud Museum, and if you look at photos of Freud in his later years, late 60s, early 70s, he looked similar to this. That was my reality, right? And when I said that, this gentleman who drew this beautiful drawing, I could see his face. He was devastated. He gave me this gift, and I said it was Sigmund Freud? It was Tagore, who was the first Indian to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. He was Indian. Two different realities, right? Two different realities. Now, it is true that in practically every session that I give this talk to, there are a few people who say it's you, Joe. How many of you thought it was me? Okay, we got about three or four people. And the reason for it, I'm speculating, is, well, I don't really have an anchor for this, but this Joe fellow, he's got a beard. He seems to be somewhat elderly. You like that caveat, somewhat elderly, right? And that's the reason they say it's you, because that's the narrative. That's the immediate narrative that drives the perception. That is a map of the world. How many of you are born and raised in the United States? When we looked at a map and when we were going to school, where is the United States in the map? Right in the middle, right? So if you go to China, where is the map? Right in the middle. If you go to Europe, in general, Europe is right in the middle. This map is from Australia. And so you see how what you're used to, and look at this, you say, and you even see different proportions, right? Most people, when they look at a U.S.-American map, they basically see Africa, which is close to the same size as the continental United States, but they don't realize it's 3.5 times the size, right? Okay. Okay, what do you see now? You see a Muni bus. Anybody see anything else? Burkas. How many see burkas? Woo! This is the power. This is the power of social media. Folks, these are seats in a Norwegian bus. Now this comes to... This is an implication of how people distort social media and spread lies across cultures, right? So somebody on the extreme right who was getting freaked out about immigrants coming to Norway and wanted to fuel fear of our immigrants, he put this on social media in Norway, knowing that a large number of people in the population would think, oh, burkas, they're overwhelming us. They're overwhelming us. A total distortion. And you see, even each of you had your own sense of what this was. And you should ask yourself, why did I see that? Was it the influence of what I'm watching on television? Is it something else? Somebody who said Muni. Do you go on the Muni a lot?
Yep.
Oh, there it is. Okay, there's a sign. And Isis Oasis. Okay. Look at that. Sanctuary, temple services, lovely lodging, venue for events. You know where my wife and I saw this? Geysersville, California. Who was ISIS? You know, again, ISIS is in the news all the time. Most of us don't realize that there are 250 companies around the world with the letters ISIS. Has nothing to do with ISIS. And many of them have had to change their names because they were losing business. ISIS, who was ISIS? The goddess of, an Egyptian goddess of nurturing, right? Am I right? Anybody want to contradict that? Because I am limited also. So again, you can imagine people driving through Kaisersville who know nothing about ISIS and seeing this, they want to get the hell out of there as fast as possible. Hokey dokey. Now, depending on what your experiences have been with people with a bald head, right? Whether they have a tattoo or what they're wearing, most of us would have a reaction depending on our experience, what we've been exposed to. So one of the reasons that I chose a cover, the back of a bald head, militant, monk, punk, patient. So again, you know, one could totally misunderstand, and depending on the circumstances, if somebody, you've had a bad experience with someone with a bald head, you know, you could miss an opportunity maybe for a romance. Who knows, right? So basically, what I want to tell you about this is a story that I experienced with my wife in Germany several years ago. My wife, Donna, wrote a book about Israeli society. Who are the Israelis? All kinds of Jews, all kinds of Arabs, the Druze, right? Ethiopian Jews, Indian Jews, all kinds of people of Arabic descent. And she was giving the talk in Germany, right? So, yes, every time Donna spoke, there was a guard, an armed guard, at wherever she spoke because of fear of Nazis, neo-Nazis. And so I was sitting in the back, and I was sitting next to an Israeli woman who was reading The Kite Runner in Hebrew. And there I was sitting there, and there was an armed guard outside, but just as Donna began her talk, a gentleman walked in with a leather jacket, bald, sat right next to me. And so my prism, we're in Germany, we know this is a reality that people viscerally react for whatever reasons, right? And all of a sudden, he looked over and he saw this Israeli woman reading The Kite Runner in Hebrew, and he started speaking Hebrew to her. Who was he? He was an Israeli ballet dancer. Okay, so let us now kind of quickly give a couple of examples of how this is playing out with immigrants, refugees today, right? Because we see it in the news, and because it's happening so quickly, so many of us have encounters with refugees, with immigrants, and without knowing much about their background, what they've experienced. So, for example, let me take it to the medical world, because one of the first things that refugees need is medical assistance. And a lot of Western psychologists think, well, if they've experienced trauma, they need a therapist, right? Talk therapy. And talk therapy, for many of us, for those of us who were born and raised in the United States, is a positive. I come from New York City, folks. If you were not seeing a psychologist, there was something wrong with you. So here is the issue here. Many of the people who are coming from the countries flowing into the United States from various places are not used to talk therapy. Why would you want to tell your most intimate problems to a stranger? Some of us feel more comfortable and secure giving some of this information to someone we do not know, right? So talk therapy just doesn't work in a lot of cases. Secondly, suppose they have experienced physical trauma, torture, right? So many of them will come here, and yes, Westerners sometimes will have them go to a hospital to check them out, and they put them in a hospital room. Now think about this for a second. For those of you who've ever been in a hospital room, either as a patient or as a visitor, how many chairs are in the hospital room, usually? One, maybe two, right? So most of these people are coming from countries where if you're in a hospital room, if there are hospitals where they're coming from, Everybody comes. The whole family, 20 people come. What do you mean visiting hours are only 3 or 4 hours? This is my child. This is my spouse. This is a loved one. Why should I be limited to 1 or 2 chairs, right? What do you mean I can't feed them? So this is kind of, you know, this is kind of part of the shock. And then in addition to that, in some of the hospital rooms where they're sitting alone sometimes, they will see, let's say they've experienced torture and they see a stethoscope or a blood pressure cuff on the wall. What is their reality? These are instruments of torture. This is one of the most difficult things that many of the refugees experience. Now, one of the famous stories about some of the Vietnamese refugees was the question of how do we treat somebody who is giving birth, right? So when you're giving birth, I'm told, right, it's really important to stay hydrated. So this Vietnamese woman was giving birth, and they kept giving her cold water to keep her hydrated. But she kept pushing it aside, and they kept coming back, and they thought she had the water and that she'd be fine. No, she was continued to be dehydrated, right? Mm-hmm. Why? Because in many Asian cultures in particular, the notion of health is driven by hot and cold. The body is in a hot condition, you give them something that is characterized as cold and vice versa. So when they finally gave her warm water, because the pain of birth giving is interpreted as being in a cold state in Vietnamese culture, it's my understanding, right? When she got the warm water, everything was fine. Cupping, coining. How many of you have ever seen, even today in the Bay Area, people with red marks on their necks, on their legs? Yeah, you've seen it, right? So people who've never seen that, immediately the assumption is there's child abuse. Child abuse. They're being beaten by someone. And there are cases of children being taken away from their parents, usually Asian parents, because social service agencies who haven't been educated in cross-cultural differences think that the kid is being abused, right? And so there's a tragic story about a Vietnamese gentleman whose son was taken away from him, and he was accused by the police and social workers in his community about abusing his son. It was so painful, so humiliating that he committed suicide. Right? So this is kind of just a symptom of the kinds of miscommunications, misunderstandings that arise. Pain. Pain. Just like holding hands is defined culturally across cultures, pain and expressing pain is often expressed differently. In many Asian cultures, it's important to be stoic, not to show your emotions. So you can imagine if you're an ambulance driver and somebody's in great pain and happens to be from a country in Asia, let us say, who's in great pain but doesn't show it with expression, they may not be treating the person properly. In many countries from the Middle East, they find that generally, if you're in pain, you really let it out. You let it go, right? And that they find many people from Middle Eastern countries, not all, have asked more frequently for pain relievers than anybody else, right? Pap smears, right? A lot of refugees coming from countries where it's important that people be perceived as virgins before they marry, they do not want to have a pap smear, because they're afraid that this is going to make it appear that they're no longer a virgin. Well, if you get somebody from the country who understands this and realizes you could administer a pap smear without interfering with somebody's hymen, then you have a different story. Let us talk about six. Remember six? Why do six wear turbans? One of the reasons they wear turbans is they don't like to cut their hair, right? And they don't want to cut their hair frequently is because hair is considered a gift of God. You don't cut hair, right? So let's say, and there are stories about this, where six, for example, go into a hospital and they have to get an angiogram, right? Where they're trying to see how the condition of the vessels and they have to put a catheter in, right? So they put a catheter in and the sick basically stops them right away because it means, for those of you familiar with this, that you have to cut the hair before you put the catheter in. Why is this person freaking out? Another example, and the reason I come and focus for the moment on the question of health is because that is frequently the most immediate challenge that refugees and immigrants have. I want to now just kind of give you a little segment about another challenge that many from the refugee communities experience. In Canada, you may know, one of the main differences between the way they handle refugees and the way we do it in the United States is, for the most part, you're supposed to have a family that sponsors you for the first year. That means they're watching over you, they're helping you financially, they're counseling you, they're with you. It's more that collective spirit that the Canadians understand. So what is the difference between an immigrant and a refugee? And I kind of captured this from an article I read, and I thought this would be revealing. Particularly when the parents come with a certain culture and the children are brought up in a different culture, whether in Canada or in the United States, for example, or in Europe, and they are being influenced by the messages of their peers. So, for example, Syrian parents were confused when they discovered that they were Canadian teenagers who stayed out past midnight and moved away from home when they turned 18. When their daughter asked to go on a 3-day overnight trip with their fifth grade classmates, her father refused, saying he was not an immigrant who was trying to adapt to a new world. He was an immigrant trying to hold on to what had been ripped away from him. And they were basically freaked out because the daughter also wanted to have ballet dancing. So you know that in some Muslim countries, modesty is really important. Ballet dancing? A skimpy skirt? This is horrifying, right? While his daughter found much that was fresh and exciting in her new homeland, she was bothered by Canadian divorces and by stories from her classmates about parents who lived in separate homes. Again, this is such a shock for somebody who has a particular prism. Let's just kind of shift a second to war zones, where NATO soldiers frequently are set down in countries where they don't understand the culture at all. So, for example, to give you this sense, in Iraq, this was some time ago, but still in Iraq, when NATO soldiers, American soldiers in this particular case, would stop Iraqi drivers at checkpoints to see if there were guns, ammunition in the cars, they would do this to stop. What else could this mean? Hello. Right, and that's exactly how many of the Iraqis interpreted it, and they drove through the checkpoint, and many of them were killed for driving through the checkpoint because this gesture was misunderstood, right?
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
In Afghanistan, look at how many of you are folding your legs right now? One leg over the other, right? So, you know, when you travel to certain countries where there's a sensitivity about the sole of a shoe, you are insulting this gentleman right over here. You're insulting her. You are insulting her with your foot in this way, with the sole of the foot. So we don't know these things. This is just a natural thing. It's not good or bad. It's different. And so the message of all of this is, what else could this mean? Shaking hands, right? In the United States, for example, generally a firm handshake means engagement, right? Engagement, honesty, right? In many countries, people don't shake hands, as you well know. And as well as that, in some countries, people will shake hands with a very light touch. So, Norma, would you come and shake hands with me? So I'm going to shake hands with you. How's that doing? Okay?
Very firm.
Okay, but if I did it this way,
shy or weak,
right? So many immigrants who come to this country and go to job interviews, they will often shake hands with a very limp shake of the hand, and they mean it to be graceful. But they may have lost their first good impression in a job interview because they're not engaging. Eye contact. What do we think about when we're talking about eye contact? Eye contact, we're engaged, right? We are engaged. If I wasn't having some kind of eye contact with you, you'd say, well, you know, he's not with us. But in many cultures, throughout Africa, throughout the Middle East, many parts of Asia, averted eye contact with somebody in authority or an elder is a sign of respect. I remember in Kenya, some of our students, if they had to have a chat with the principal, And the principal, who was an Italian priest at the time when I was there, has nothing to do with Catholicism. Basically, he saw that the students would lower their eyes. And he said, you see these African students? They're all devious. They're not telling you the truth. Completely wrong. Completely wrong. Right? And immigrants, refugees who come to this country, another thing that they are asked to do at job interviews, for example, is to talk about their accomplishments. So if I ask most of you about your accomplishments, understanding that some of you are more modest than others, some of you are more egocentric than others, most of you would start the answer with the word I. Would it surprise you to know that some of these immigrants will start the answer with we? What's your greatest accomplishment in your last job? And the answer starts with we. And the answer to that question is, why are you saying that? The person will tell you, I could not have done this without the assistance of many other people. It's again the difference between a more collectivistic and a more individualistic culture. Modesty. In most Asian cultures, for example, again, most, it's really important not to stand out. So, for example, there's a wonderful Japanese proverb many of you perhaps know. It goes like this. When a nail sticks up, hammer it down. Don't stand out, because in that way you are kind of undermining, you're undermining the sense of the group. You need to, and that is the reason why even at UC Berkeley today, and despite the changes in the one-child policy, which has, you know, now beginning to change again, many Asian students born and raised in Asia do not raise their hand in class. So what's the interpretation of some of the folks who see this? Oh, they're not engaged. They're not initiating. It has nothing to do with that. It has respect for the rest of the class. Why should I take their time? Why should I interrupt the teacher? These things are totally, totally misunderstood. And I cannot tell you to this day how many students from many Asian countries say to me, why are all these Americans smiling at me? Why? You know, when we smile at strangers along the road, basically we are, in a sense, showing something that makes us comfortable, casual, right? But for many people, to be encountered with a smile from a stranger is totally alienating. Totally alienating. And I'll just kind of close with two comments. If you think that smiling is universal, think about Thailand. There are 12 different kinds of smiles in Thailand. And some of them have to do with anger, without trying to avoid showing any kind of conflict. Okay? And so let me finish with something that happened very recently to me at one of these talks. Somebody from a refugee area came up to me and said, you know, some of you Americans just are so ignorant about the rest of the world. One gentleman asked me if I have in my country July 4th. And my answer to him was, yes, of course we have July 4th and July 5th and July 6th and July 7th. Right? So the reason I wrote the book is because I think we're in this time of great toxicity, partially fueled by these contacts without any kind of context. So let me stop there and invite you all to share your stories, ask questions, correct me if you think that's appropriate.
As you see here, I have a microphone, and also we have a standing microphone here. So if you'd like, I know it's kind of crowded, maybe hard to get to the standing mic. So if you'd like to ask a question, raise your hand, and I'll, okay, I see.
My question is, you dealt little with the question of language misinterpretations.
Yes.
When people attempt to share a common language, there are often differences in the meaning of words.
Right.
That can be taken incorrectly by one person or another.
Totally agree.
Could you address that slightly?
I want to just be selflessly promotional. Selfishly promotional. There's a whole chapter in the book about language. And for example, let's talk about British English and American English. Right? So when we say let's table an issue in the United States, we are saying put it off. If you're in the United Kingdom, to table an issue means let's talk about it now. And if you've been following these Brexit discussions, you know that that is, in fact, what one of the issues has been, right? I wrote an essay in that chapter about guns, right? Because I think one of the best ways to understand a culture is to look at its language and see what are the words that repeat themselves over and over again. I found something like 45 expressions related to guns. Shoot me an email, a shot in the dark, all of that, which is documented there. Let me give you another example of a misunderstanding in language. At International House, a student once, a U.S.-American student came to me and said, I had the damnedest experience this morning. A student from China came up to me and said, have you eaten? And I said, and the American student said, yes, would you like to go to lunch? And the Chinese student said, well, I already ate. Very puzzling, right? Because have you eaten in some Chinese languages means how are you? How are you? Totally different. Totally different. I was mentoring a woman from Pakistan, and I was looking at her resume, and I noticed that she wasn't being consistent with her use of periods. And when I said to her, you know, you're not being consistent with your use of periods, she said to me, she said nothing, and that was a signal to me that we were not communicating. She didn't want to say, I don't understand, because in many cultures, people don't say, I don't understand, because it's shameful to say, I don't understand. So all of a sudden, I remembered that in Pakistan, what kind of English do they speak?
British
English. How do you say period in British English? Full stop. And so when I said, oh, you're not being consistent with your full stops, then we connected again. This was another example of this, right? And then I told the story to some gentleman. He was fairly orthodox Muslim from Egypt. And he said, Joe, you got it all wrong. She had nothing to do with full stop and period. She was nervous about talking about her menstrual cycle with a man. Period. So yes, absolutely right. It finally came, right? It came, right. So yeah, all of these things are really, really striking. What could all of these things mean in context? What does tone mean? And this is part of the problem I think we're having with texts. Texts don't tell you tone. They have no context, right? And even we're being sped up so fast nowadays, even texts are seeming inadequate for some in the younger generation, really young generation, so they're using emojis instead. And how you interpret an emoji, amazing, I write about this in the book as well, is completely different across cultures. How you use Facebook is completely different across cultures, depending upon the underlying reality. Other? Yes?
I am a language person. And I went to Berkeley. I know. And I was, anyway. So playing off of his notion of language, I have always believed that language is a key to understanding culture because there are so many words that cannot be translated. And it seems like the world is becoming more and more English-based. There seems to be a forcible movement toward English. And it seems like this notion of perception and deception does come back to the understanding of language. What do you think about promoting and understanding more multilingual bases rather than just going to an English-based world?
You know, in 1980, I wrote a piece called America Globally Blind, Deaf, and Dumb. And it was about language deficiency that still in this country, it's still possible to get a PhD in some places and never have studied another language, right? And even today, I think it's something like 25% of the positions in the Foreign Service are unfilled by people who can speak the language. You know, our ambassadors, most of them, many of them are, not all, but many of them are political appointees. They have no idea. Forget about the language. No idea. So I think it's really important for a number of reasons. A, we are living in a globalized world. And, you know, when you speak someone else's language, you're showing them a degree of respect, even if it's just a few phrases. How many times if you've been to China or Japan and you say ni hao ma or konnichiwa, oh, you speak such beautiful language. I'm so happy. I'm so happy. So I also think it's important because when you speak another language, there's another reality, in my opinion, that you see that you couldn't see. So I had the good fortune of living in France for 4 years, and I came to be reasonably okay in French. And I realized I could not translate certain things that I'd learned in French back into English. It just can't do it. Can you give us an example of something that doesn't translate?
you know, something simple. For example, the end of a German phrase, you would say, das stimmt, oder? You know, that's right, right? Or even in English, you know, English, at least in my experience, it's the only language where you can say the same word twice right. for emphasis, and in no other language or to a foreigner that wouldn't make any sense. Like, do you like him or do you like him? and that won't make sense to a foreigner.
Right, exactly.
So, I mean, in English that makes sense and in other languages, but they're culturally sensitive words and phrases that really are not translatable. And that's so core to traditions and history that I believe are getting lost in this forcibly English-based world. And, you know.
And I agree with you completely. But on the other hand, when you've seen all these advertisements for Babbel, you know, that's going to teach you all these languages. So in a sense, that is also responding to globalization. There's going to be more travel. There's going to be more contact with people. So I took that on. We know that it's very difficult to translate poetry from one language to another, right? Just that simple principle, any language. So now I think this is where, and I know the techie people have a lot to teach me. I know that. On the other hand, for them to think that you can translate a language with algorithms, right? Here it is, folks. I was ready for this. Translation issues. One can appreciate the serious diplomatic implications of inadequate computer translations when considering these recent, since-corrected Google translations. Russian Federation, translated as Lord of the Rings. Russians, translated as occupiers. Well, you could see, but nonetheless, is Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, translated as sad little horse. And it goes on. It goes on. So basically, and I think if you just kind of watch this notion of, you know, this is going to connect us. Technology is going to connect us. I think the irony is, yes, in some ways it does, but in some ways it deepens disconnection. It deepens disconnection. And that's why I challenge you to kind of look at your Facebook friends who come from other countries. What is on their page? How do they portray themselves compared to the way we do it? It's really kind of striking. So even in the area of social media, which many people say, oh, it's going to bring us all together, et cetera, not necessarily. In fact, it could deepen disconnection. Anyone else? Yeah.
Two things. The first is a quick one. Where did you serve in the Peace Corps in Kenya?
Kenya.
In Kenya, where?
Karagoya. Kati ya Nyeri Nambu. Did you live in Kenya?
No, I visit there.
Okay. Did you ever hear of Karagoya?
Where is it? What part of the country?
It's about 100 miles north of Nairobi.
Okay, past the area.
And could I just pause there for a second? I can't resist. So one of the really powerful things about the Peace Corps for me was not only the discovery of all of these things that I didn't realize had other meanings, but that I was in a village, and this is not necessarily the case. There are Peace Corps volunteers all over the world who will sometimes be in urban areas, et cetera, but still cultural differences. And this village had no hot water, no running water, right? No electricity. One phone for 10,000 people. This was an enormous cultural shock for me. And when I came back to the United States, one of the expressions, you know how certain expressions tell you about the culture in which we're living? I kept hearing the word hassle. I'd never heard how people were hassling each other before I went into the Peace Corps. But this was, I think, a signal of, you know, don't bother. Things should be easy. Don't hassle me. Don't hassle me. I think that we are lacking with this culture of immediate gratification. Get it now. Get the right information. Push the button. I think we are emotionally stunting ourselves. Okay. And the second question.
The second was interesting observation. In my friends in Uganda, if you ask them how they're doing, they'll say, not bad. In Kenya, if you ask someone how they're doing, no matter if they're on their deathbed or not, they'll say, very well.
Right. So, but let's take a pause here on language. There are over 50 languages in Kenya, probably close to that in Uganda. So was it anecdotal and this was a particular individual, or was this a question of how they were translating their particular language? I mean, if you think 50 languages is a lot in one country, in Nigeria there are over 300 languages, not dialects, languages. And some of them are drum languages. How many of you have ever heard of drum languages? Okay. So, drum language, most people when they hear this is, oh my God, they're giving signals on drums. Now, West African languages, many West African languages, not all, are tonal languages in the same way that Chinese is a tonal language and other languages are tonal. You can change the meaning of a word, you can change the context, you can change the gender, a lot of things by changing the tone. In some Nigerian languages, you can actually tell the entire history of a people and recite poetry, Yoruba, for example, by beating the drums without saying a word. And this is important to tell people who say, oh, these people are uncivilized, they didn't have a written language. Which, of course, is also mistaken, because, of course, Amharic is a very, long-standing, very ancient language as well. It comes from Ge'ez in Ethiopia. So, again, this whole question of, one of the reasons I start the book is with my experiences in Africa is because I could see how certain ideas about Africa translated into our own society and infected us. Okay.
Yeah, you mentioned that that these lessons are really important as our world is increasingly globalized. I agree with that. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the arenas that you think it's most important for these lessons to be understood and the ways in which the lessons might be shared, either ways that you've thought about, ways that you've seen that happening, or ways that we could do it in the future.
Okay, so with, you know, obviously I think health is a really important thing with people crossing borders so rapidly, and health is important to life. I think diplomacy is critical. I mean, our president, I'm not going to get into that, okay, but this is an illustration of other things that happen in the diplomatic world. He referred to the leader of Korea as Mr. Un. Now, if he knew anything or if he'd been properly briefed in many languages in Asia, in China, for example, or in Korea, the first name you see is the family name. Kim is the family name. He should have said Mr. Kim, right? Or probably add an appropriate honorific. So Mr. Un, right? Diplomacy, business. Here's a business example, right? When I ask you the question, what does ASAP mean? Ashley, what does ASAP mean?
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible. Now let's take it another step. What does that mean?
As fast as you can get it.
All right. Go ahead. Give me some concrete evidence. What does that mean? As fast as possible could mean what? As soon as possible.
It could mean tomorrow. It could be 5 minutes.
Right. 5 minutes of tomorrow. That's her window. I understand that, Ashley. So I have been working with a gentleman from Honduras, right? And many of you know that there are different concepts of time. 8 o'clock could mean 9 o'clock in many countries. It's a metaphor. People understand this. You need to understand it. At any rate, he comes from Honduras, and when somebody says, I need it as soon as possible, it means something totally different from here. He has been in this country, this Honduran gentleman, for 15 years, right? So he has now understood what ASAP means, which generally many of us, I would assume, today, tomorrow. As soon as possible. He is currently doing business with colleagues in Honduras, and he's lost touch with his culture. And he said to me, Joe, I kept saying I need the document as soon as possible. And they said, well, that means in 2 or 3, I had other things to do. They didn't get the document for 3 months. And they, as far as they're concerned, I had other things to do. I was asked to do a training for a Silicon Valley company. We'll just end on this. We'll take one more question. And the company had a contract with Brazilians. It was a 500-page contract. And they just could not come to understand each other's realities. The word deadline. Now, we have a language person here. Can you think of any language in your experience that has the word deadline?
No.
That's it. And some Brazilians have told me, well, the way I would translate this is with the word hope. So this basically got in the way of, you know, this long, bitter dispute about was the contract being honored or not. Yes, it was being honored, but from two different perspectives. So what do we do about this? I think that, you know, it's going to take a while. Many of us have been saying this for a while. Every single student who goes to college in this country, I would even say in high school, should be spending a semester or a year abroad. in an intensive language program. The problem with many study abroad programs in this country, in my opinion, is they're little American islands. They're living with Americans, right? They're living with Americans. They're not necessarily taking classes with people from the local culture. This makes no sense to me. So I think that that has to happen. More and more, we're now seeing that students are getting offered courses in intercultural competence, that more and more companies are requiring it because they're seeing they're losing business. They are losing business because they don't understand the other person's reality. They don't understand that the way you say no in some cultures is maybe. And that means no. It doesn't mean maybe, right? So intercultural,
the French say it's interesting.
Ah, c'est très intéressant. Oui. Or, you know, the British with their talent for understatement might say that's not bad, which means it's awful. One more question.
I have a question and a shameless plug, but I'll start with the question. So you talk a lot about the different stories that that you've had, personal experiences, but what tools would you bring other than things like mindfulness or doing your research about a culture to maybe reduce some of these misconceptions or, you know, how we can be more prepared moving forward, going to different places. Okay. And my quick shameless plug is the AIEA conference, or the Association of International Education Administrators. That conference is going on this weekend, and we are looking for volunteers. So if anybody's interested, has any questions, please see me after the event.
Okay. So what one thing, and I didn't ask her to ask this question, but I'm going to take advantage of the question. The new part of the book is at the end of each chapter, I have these exercises that are meant to ask the reader to reflect on the chapter in ways that raise intercultural competence, right? So this is number one. Number two, a very simple tool. When you meet somebody who's coming to this country for the first time or even after a while, ask them what they have seen in this country that they never saw in their own country. Don't ask them what shocked them. Don't ask them what's negative, because often they won't tell you because they don't want to be confrontational. Just say, what did you see? And what that answer will tell you is something you haven't seen about your own culture, right? And it'll give you an insight into their culture. So here's to illustrate the point. I was doing a training with Korean journalists, and I asked them to go out into San Francisco and to tell me everything they saw that they'd never seen in their own country. And this is what they said, all of them. So many Americans eat alone, walk alone, go to the movies alone. Are you mentally distressed? So what that tells you, and you know, for all of the pluses, everything has pluses and minuses. For all of the pluses about individualism and initiative and all of those things, there are a lot of minuses. And this is why, for example, in some cultures, people don't even say, I love you. That may be a shock to some of you, but in many cultures, people do not say, I love you, to their parents or their spouses. Why? Because they show it with their actions. And when you come from a group culture, you have all of this group support. You don't need to say, I love you. But when you come from an individualistic society, you're more likely to feel vulnerable and need support. And that is why I am suggesting to you, we need to say ourselves, I love you. How many of you, when you hang up the phone, love you? Love you all. Thank you for coming.
Our thanks to Joe Lurie, author of Perception and Deception, A Mind-Opening Journey Across Cultures. He is also a cross-cultural communications trainer and executive director emeritus of UC Berkeley's International House, and as you saw, a very good speaker. We thank our audience here for your thoughtful questions and our listening audience. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in its 116th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.